In Haiti, the prime minister was just fired by the country's transitional council. The council named a new interim leader, but it's far from clear what comes next.
Every lawyer you talk to has a different interpretation about what the rights, the limits of this ruling council, you know, where they are.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, more on the constitutional crisis in Haiti. Also, President-elect Donald Trump says he's been on the phone with many world leaders. One of them reportedly was Vladimir Putin. That set off alarm bells in Ukraine.
Trump may make it more difficult for Ukraine to make much progress on the ground.
And in parts of Pakistan and northern India, air pollution is reaching dangerous new levels.
Everybody born in the north is a smoker from their first breath.
Some say it's time for smog diplomacy. All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us on this Monday. Carolyn Beeler is off today. There's a lot of news to get to, and we start with Haiti, where the country's transitional council has sacked the prime minister. Gary Conille was just appointed to the position in May. He says the council's decision to fire him is illegal. The transitional council and Conille were meant to bring stability to the troubles in Haiti. Now it's not clear what comes next at the highest level of government there. Jacqueline Charles knows this story well. She's been reporting on Haiti for more than a decade with the Miami Herald.
Prime Minister Gary Conille and the ruling presidential council have been at odds now for several weeks over a couple of issues, primarily the reshuffling of the government, which the council wanted, and also the fate of three members of the council who've been accused of corruption. And because they could not reach any agreement, the council late last week basically moved to sack the prime minister, as you mentioned. And there's been a lot of questions and debate about whether or not legally they had the right to do that.
Yeah, what do you make of Conille's argument that his ouster is illegal?
You know, one of the issues is that there was a political accord. This is not something that was rooted in the Constitution, and that political accord, which was forged with the help of Washington and the Caribbean community, really did not have a lot of safeguards in terms of how do you deal with these issues. I mean, theoretically, under a constitutional government in Haiti, the president cannot fire the prime minister, although we know that presidents have fired prime ministers. They just usually work through parliament. Right now in Haiti, there is no parliament. There is no elected president. In fact, there's not one elected, democratically elected person in Haiti. So what we've been seeing is just improvisation as you go along. And this famous political accord, which was dated April 3rd, has never really been officially promulgated in the country's official journal.
I mean, the judicial system in Haiti right now is hampered as well, to say the least. Does Conille have any recourse here?
Every lawyer you talk to has a different interpretation about what the rights, the limits of this ruling council, you know, where they are. So that is a very gray area for a lot of people right now.
So three members of the transitional presidential council that booted the prime minister have themselves faced corruption accusations in connection with a bank bribery scandal. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so these three individuals are currently under criminal investigation by an investigative judge after the anti-corruption unit found that there was cause that this should be forwarded to the judicial system. They have refused to step down. They have insisted on their innocence, and their presence on this council basically gave a majority vote in order for the council to take major decisions, one of which last week we saw was the firing of the prime minister.
So you think that played a role in their decision?
I don't know in terms of what played a role in their decision. What I do know is that Conille and the council, you know, have had serious disagreements over a number of issues. The prime minister has written letters publicly to say that he does not think that reshuffling the government is going to solve or address some of the issues or concerns that have been raised. There's a mechanism that was supposed to be put in place to assess the government, to evaluate it. That was never done. But ultimately, he lost that battle with them deciding that they were going to name a new prime minister. Now, when you talk to the different political parties that are involved in this transition, they have different opinions of them. Not all of them are in agreement with what the ruling council has done. But as of this moment, there has been an executive order that was published. We do not know whether or not Prime Minister Gary Conille is going to leave. Are we going to have two prime ministers along with the nine presidents that you already have? Again, the fact that this was not rooted out of a constitution, it is not something that has been done in Haiti in recent memory. It just leaves a lot of questions and a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, so uncharted waters. Tell us about Alix Didier Fils-Aimé, the entrepreneur that the council has named as Haiti's new prime minister. What should we know about him?
So he's based in Port-au-Prince. He's a businessman. He previously ran for the Haitian parliament, specifically the Senate in 2015. It was an unsuccessful bid. His father, Alix Boulon-Fizimé, was a member of the private cabinet of the late President René Préval. He was involved in the disarmament of arms. Didi Fizimé himself was among those who were vying to replace Ariel Henry earlier this year. And instead of going with him, they went with Gary Kony. We're not sure in terms of what process that was used this time around, but what we saw was that they did not reopen the process in terms of inviting new candidates for the job of prime minister, and they've now decided to tap him to lead the government.
So while Haiti tries to figure out the leadership situation, at the same time, there's this UN-backed armed force led by some 400 Kenyan police. They're in Haiti right now trying to rein in the armed gangs who control most of the capital. How is that effort going?
Well, it's been a struggling effort because this is a force that's been under-resourced, understaffed. The money that, you know, the United States was hoping would come through from the international community to keep this force going, it hasn't really materialized. There are supposed to be 600 individuals, police officers in Kenya who are supposed to be deployed. We don't know now with this latest decision what the impact of it's going to be. And the reality is what we're seeing is the gangs have continued to make inroads. They've continued to take over towns. They've had an awful massacre in a town of Ponsonde, where dozens of people were killed in the middle of the night. And so it has been a huge challenge for this international force.
As Spirit Airlines resumed daily commercial service to Haiti back in May, today it apparently ran into some trouble. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So we have been reporting that a Spirit Airline flight from Fort Lauderdale, as it was approaching the landing in Port-au-Prince, it was shot at, forcing that flight to divert to Santiago in the Dominican Republic, where it safely landed. And so this is a disturbing update of what's happened.
Finally, Jacqueline, how have gang leaders in Haiti, like Jimmy Cherizier, the former police officer nicknamed Barbecue, how have people like him reacted to the ouster of the prime minister?
Well, that is a story that's developing. There were concerns yesterday that there were going to be violence on the streets. Some schools did not open today. People have been very concerned, but we are watching that closely to see if there's any development and how the gangs react.
The Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles on the firing of Haiti's Prime Minister Gary Kony. Thick smog is blanketing parts of northern India and eastern Pakistan. The air quality has been so bad that authorities in Pakistan closed schools and urged people to stay home. Meantime, in the Indian capital of Delhi, officials are impounding vehicles that don't meet pollution restrictions. Some say it's time for the two rival nations to work together on smog diplomacy, as we hear from the world's Jeremy Siegel.
Jyoti Pandey Lavakari was born and raised in New Delhi. As an adult, after living and working abroad for years as a journalist, she decided to make the move back home.
My children were little. I wanted them to grow up in India, understanding what their background, culture, heritage, and identity was.
So they packed up their bags and left. But Lavakari says she soon realized that might have been a mistake.
Unfortunately, at that time, I did not know how bad the air quality in New Delhi and all of North India was.
After moving back, she saw how every year, during the colder months when more pollution gets trapped in the region, her children were getting sick and their friends were too.
And a bunch of us mothers basically got together and we tried to spread awareness. We set up this organization called Care for Air, and we went from school to school and hospital to hospital just trying to tell people that look, there is a killer out there. It's not just affecting our respiratory system. It's affecting every part of our anatomy.
According to the WHO, exposure to air pollution puts people at risk for stroke, heart disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, lung cancer, pneumonia, and cataracts. And Lavakari says people who live in northern India and eastern Pakistan are at higher risk. It's as if
everybody born in the north is a smoker from their first breath.
Because of how bad the air is, Lavakari has become what she calls a pollution refugee, fleeing the region to other parts of the country when the air gets bad. But that's not possible for everyone in Delhi.
Every time I step out, either my eyes, you know, turn red or my head hurts.
That's Tanushree Ganguly, director of the Air Quality Life Index in Delhi. She says the numbers can be shocking. In Delhi and in the megacity of Lahore across the border in Pakistan, pollution levels are 15 to 20 times what the WHO recommends.
An average resident in Delhi is likely to lose more than 7 years of their life if they're exposed to this pollution level. In case of Lahore, an average individual is likely to lose more than 5 years of their life if they're exposed to such pollution levels in a sustained manner.
This time of year, pollution in the region tends to come to a head when the usual relentless emissions from factories and a growing number of cars is compounded by crop burning, trash burning, and fireworks from Diwali celebrations. On top of that, the unique meteorology of the area traps everything in the air, carrying it from city to city.
The air pollution issue here is a regional problem.
Bhupesh Adhikari is an air quality expert with the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development in Nepal. He says measures that Delhi has put in place, like cracking down on polluting vehicles during periods of peak pollution, are helpful. But that's just putting a Band-Aid on one piece of the problem in one city. Real change, he says, will come from a regional approach.
To really solve the problem, countries, you know, must come together and, you know, work on the issue, partly to deliver at scale.
This week, officials in Pakistan put forward a proposal to do just that when the leaders of the provincial government in Punjab called on their Indian counterparts to collaborate on fighting pollution. Michael Kugelman is the director of the South Asia Institute at the Wilson Center.
I'm not terribly optimistic about this just because of how fraught the relationship is between India and Pakistan.
The two countries have had a long and complex history of hostility rooted in the partition of British India in the 1940s. In recent years, Kugelman says, there have been efforts to work together on things like COVID and disaster relief, often to no avail. But this time could be different.
This is a subnational effort. This is not something that's being initiated by the central governments. This is something that's being initiated by a chief minister, which is essentially equivalent to a governor in the United States. And perhaps a subnational effort at diplomacy can be more effective.
Kugelman says if that were to happen, it would be a huge confidence booster for future diplomacy between the two nations. Pollution advocates like Jyoti Pandey Lavakari aren't holding out hope. She says within India, there's no agreement on how to tackle pollution, only a blame game.
If you can't even fix this problem within a country between states, how are you going to fix it cross-border? I don't see it happening.
But Lavakari says something needs to be done, and fast, because people are dying just from breathing in the air where they live. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
It is The Case of the Missing Paperwork, a controversial novel by acclaimed author Salman Rushdie, can now be legally bought in his native India. The Satanic Verses was banned there and other parts of the world when many Muslims took issue with the book when it was published in 1988. That edict was overturned by an Indian court in recent days, essentially because they couldn't find any proof of that edict. A petitioner had challenged the government's import ban on the book, and the government agency that oversees taxes and customs couldn't find any records of the ban, either on paper or online. The book's publication caused a furor 36 years ago, some of which has calmed down since then. In this archival interview with a Canadian interviewer several years ago, Rushdie commented on how opinions had changed about the book.
You know, I mean, I feel very proud of that book. And I think one of the great things about the time having passed is that now people can read the Satanic Verses as a novel, you know, instead of as some kind of hot potato.
When the Satanic Verses was published, Iran's supreme leader called for Rushdie's death, forcing the author into hiding in 1989. He had resumed a normal life when 2 years ago, Rushdie was attacked during a literary festival in New York. His memoir about that event called Knife was a finalist this year for the National Book Award. You're listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Patty Daniels. I'm the supervising producer for The World. When you think about this show, you might think first about the voices and the reporting you hear. It's essential journalism, and it makes you feel connected to the world around you. But there's so much more that is going on behind the scenes. It's our producers and our editors, the engineer who's behind the glass right next to me, our studio team. We're all working together to make sure this is the best journalism with the highest production values. We have to be nimble, we have to be responsive, and we rely on deep experience to make sure that this news program is the best that it can be for you every afternoon. We can't do this work without you. We have a fundraising goal right now through the end of December to raise $67,000 to support this nonprofit newsroom, and we're counting on you to make this campaign a success. Trusted global journalism, that is already reason enough to give. But here is one more incentive, my friends. Now through December 31st, your donation will be matched. Think about making a gift of $250 to the world, and our newsroom will receive $500, thanks to you and thanks to the power of teamwork. You are part of our effort here, and we couldn't thank you enough. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you. Now here's the show.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. There is a lot of news coming out of the Middle East. In Israel, the government's new foreign minister said today that there's been certain progress with the effort to end fighting with Hezbollah in Lebanon. But officials from Hezbollah denied that ceasefire talks are moving forward. Beyond that, Israel's new defense minister over the weekend claimed that Hezbollah had been defeated. And then today, the group fired nearly 200 missiles at Israel. Once again, air raid sirens warned residents in the northern Israeli city of Haifa as people scrambled for the nearest bomb shelters. Erez Geller is a regional director with Israel's emergency services. He says several people were injured today, but there were no fatalities.
We had a lot of rockets falling all over the place, so we sent a lot of ambulances, paramedics and EMTs to give first aid. So far, we evacuated 4 casualties.
Health officials in Lebanon today said that 54 people were killed and more than 50 others were wounded over the weekend in Israeli airstrikes and fighting in the south of the country. The total death toll in Lebanon after more than a year of conflict between Israel and Hezbollah is now more than 3,000 people killed and 14,000 wounded. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is hosting an Arab Islamic summit. At the event, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas asked the UN Security Council to cancel Israel's membership with the United Nations. Abbas said it was time that Israel abide by international law and end its crimes against the Palestinian people. In the Gaza Strip, officials with the Hamas-run health ministry now say that more than 40,000 people have been killed. Despite the ongoing violence, mediators from a host of countries are still working toward ceasefire deals for the wars in Lebanon and in Gaza. Qatar now says it will no longer host talks between Hamas and Israel, but experts say the Gulf country is likely to continue to play the role of mediator if there is any momentum in these ceasefire talks. As the Israeli bombing in Lebanon continues, there's been an impact on the human body. Obviously, bombs injure humans, but we're talking impacts for people who are not even in close proximity to explosions. As the world's Duri Buscarin reports, Lebanese doctors say they're seeing a sharp rise in premature births and other complications for people having kids.
In the last months of her pregnancy, Christy Maria Terce could hear the bombs.
I used to cry a lot, not because of the current situation. I used to think about the future.
Sending voice notes over the hum of her baby's noise machine, Terce says that even in utero, she could tell her daughter was suffering.
After bombings, when we heard the bombs, she would stay calm in my womb for like 24 hours. It would make me panic a lot.
A pregnancy not moving in your womb that close to your due date is not a good sign.
I knew that everything that was happening to me was happening to her too, so I didn't want her to go through what I was going through.
Terce is a fitness instructor based in northern Beirut. Israeli bombs have killed more than 3,000 people across Lebanon over the past year, but airstrikes have intensified amid Israel's ground invasion in southern Lebanon, which started in early October. 1.2 million Lebanese have been displaced from their homes. Israel says it is fighting the militant group Hezbollah, which shoots rockets almost daily towards Israel in solidarity with Hamas in the Gaza Strip. Caught in the crossfire are civilians like Terce, who doctors say are deeply impacted by the bombings nearby, especially while pregnant.
We have a lot of early miscarriages and a lot of fetal malformation that occurred really on a level that I never saw before.
Nicolas Baclini is an OBGYN practicing in Beirut. He says that for the past 3 decades that he's worked here, he'll see 1 or 2 fetal malformations every year. It's rare, but over the past 3 months in the hospital where he works, there's been a shocking increase.
We had these 3 months more than 15 fetal malformations with deaths in utero that we delivered. So you ask yourself, how come it's so frequent now?
It's anecdotal evidence of a phenomenon the medical community is still trying to understand. During war, pregnant women and the fetuses they're carrying are incredibly vulnerable to what's going on outside. Baglini says it's not clear if it's the physical sound waves from the bombs or the smoke that's carried in the air, but something is happening.
When you have a bomb falling even 300 meters from you, you have a wave that can shock your ears if you are not pregnant, but when you are pregnant, it can shock your uterus and it can give you contraction.
Pamela DiCamillo is the program coordinator in Lebanon for the United Nations Population Fund, which focuses on pregnancy and newborns.
We have been under intense bombing and displacement now for the last 2 months. And so we have been also hearing disturbing reports of miscarriages, premature birth, placenta abruption.
DiCamillo says the UN estimates 11,600 pregnant women are affected by this conflict in Lebanon. In Gaza, about 44,000 women are currently pregnant. DiCamillo says just as Gaza's health system has been targeted in Israeli attacks, hospitals and clinics in Lebanon are being targeted by Israeli airstrikes. The Israeli military claims that Hezbollah embeds its positions near health facilities. Today, half of Lebanon's primary care centers have been closed. Hospitals are operating near capacity.
But also, they are dealing with trauma. Pregnant women might not be prioritized, or some high-risk pregnancy might be overlooked.
The UNFPA has stockpiled extra blood supplies for pregnant women who hemorrhage because blood transfusions usually go to trauma patients first. DiCamillo visited pregnant women in displacement shelters in Lebanon.
One woman, she has been displaced already 4 times, and she was explaining us, like, in every wave of displacement, bleeding was starting again.
While staying at a converted school building in another town, she couldn't see her own doctor. She had no access to her medical records. She was constantly worried about her family members who stayed behind in her hometown. Meanwhile, she had to share a bathroom with hundreds of other women.
And she ended up to have a premature birth in another town.
For mothers like Christy Maria Terce, there was little she could do. So she chose to try and keep herself distracted with the rhythm of daily life.
But, you know, some memories, and I don't want that war to take everything away from us, you know?
She prepared the baby's room. She spent time with friends. She even went to a pre-scheduled maternity photo shoot with Rochelle Abdullah, an Australian-Lebanese photographer. Abdullah says a lot of expecting mothers kept their appointments.
I was shocked because I wanted to cancel everything, being an Australian with that mindset that this is dangerous. But people kept asking me, no, I can still come. Are you willing to open? And I think they gave me a sense of strength.
In one photo, Terce wears a Barbie tank top and blows a big chewing gum bubble. In another, she wears a white ruffled dress and a flower crown. But this war, she says, will always be in the background of her memories.
It took the security, the sweetness of the last few months of pregnancy. I was scared, I was worried and everything. So there were some moments that I wanted to enjoy, but I couldn't. I was insisting on going to the maternity photo shoot no matter what, because I wanted her to have these memories, these pictures to show her.
2 weeks ago, Terce gave birth to a healthy baby girl. She and her husband named her Katerina. For The World, I'm Daria Buscarin.
More global news and stories still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. The dance world has lost an icon. As a performer and choreographer with the Alvin Ailey Company, Judith Jameson dazzled audiences all over the globe.
She influenced so many people. She inspired so many people. And she gave to so many people. She's a legend. That's not going away.
Judith Jameson and A Life in Dance, ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Yesterday, The Washington Post reported that President-elect Donald Trump spoke on the phone with Russian leader Vladimir Putin. Today, a spokesperson from the Kremlin said news reports about the call were pure fiction. Meanwhile, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said that he did talk to Trump in a, quote, excellent call. We also picked up the phone today to speak with Sam Green, a professor of Russian politics at King's College London, and get his take on what's actually happening with these two relationships with key world leaders at war with each other.
Well, first of all, I mean, we have to be clear. We don't know whether the call really happened. The Kremlin denied it. That may or may not mean anything. But we would expect Trump and Putin to begin talking about this one way or another. Trump has told us that he expects to try to work on this war, if not to resolve it entirely, before he comes to office. We know that he's been in touch with Putin, you know, even when he's been out of the White House. So on that level, it's not terribly surprising, but I wouldn't read into it anything terribly meaningful either.
So Trump's team isn't confirming or denying that a call took place. A spokesman says they do not comment on private calls between Trump and other world leaders. Is there such a thing as a private call between world leaders, especially like someone like Vladimir Putin, someone the U.S. has had issues with for some two decades?
We're not entirely used to that concept coming from a place like the United States, in which we expect leaders to be accountable. We expect these calls to be held in the presence of staff. We expect minutes to be made, maybe not released to the public, but we expect that this is part of the policy process, and that policy process belongs to the United States, to the people of the United States, and not to the leader. We have archives in which all of these things are meant to be documented. That's not to say that there can't sometimes be private conversations and the necessity to keep those things out of the public view, but that's the general expectation. It is not, however, the expectation of somebody like Putin. He, other authoritarian leaders, you think about people like Xi in China or Maduro in Venezuela or Kim in North Korea, feel themselves to be much freer to have these kinds of genuinely private interactions. And I think there may be some extent to which somebody like Trump would much prefer to be able to operate in that kind of private paradigm than one in which he is held accountable to Congress or to the broader American public.
In terms of protocol, how unusual is it that someone who is not yet inaugurated as president makes a phone call like this to a world leader?
Look, I'm not a historian of the U.S. presidential politics, but we can say that President Trump in particular has not been a stickler for protocol throughout his time in and around the White House, nor has this applied to his relationships with Putin. We can remember his summit and his private meeting as part of the summit with Putin in Helsinki, in which he went into, again, a closed-door meeting with the Russian president without his advisors or staff, in fact, relying only on the Russian president's translator to make the meeting feasible. You get the sense sometimes that Trump doesn't trust his professional staff and the diplomatic staff in the room to help him run these meetings.
Sam, what kind of impact do you think this phone call could have on the Biden administration's policy on Russia and Ukraine over the coming weeks? Understanding that we don't know what was said, or as you say, we don't even have a confirmation that the call happened.
I can imagine that Trump would like to bind the hands of the Biden administration, in fact, to prevent the Biden administration from binding Trump's hands by pursuing escalation or further support for Ukraine. On the other hand, I'm not sure that Putin has the luxury of that kind of thinking, right? There are a number of months to go before Trump does finally get to occupy the White House. There are military objectives that Putin would like to achieve in that period, including making the winter as miserable as it possibly can be for ordinary Ukrainians. And he does seem to be set on communicating to Biden, to Zelensky, and to Trump himself that he has no interest in backing off. He did the other day say that he's happy to talk to Trump about an end to this war, but that it does need to be an end that is very much on Russian terms. So that does put the call very firmly in Trump's court. We certainly haven't seen anything at the moment to suggest that Trump has figured out exactly how to return that serve.
So while leaders talk on the phone, on the ground over the weekend, we saw Ukraine and Russia exchange some serious drone strikes. What does that tell you, Sam, about the way ahead for the incoming Trump administration for handling the war?
Well, again, I think it's a signal that things are not going to get easier, or at least they're going to get harder before they get easier. If either side thinks that they are headed towards the necessity of negotiations, either because they run out of room to fight or because, in fact, the U.S. government is putting them in a position, the Ukrainians in particular, in which they don't have a choice, right? They will want to strengthen their hand as much as possible before those negotiations take place. They will want to give the other side a sense that they have something to lose. We do know that Russia has set a mission for itself to make this winter as difficult as possible for the Ukrainians, and the Ukrainians are dead set on making sure that Russia does pay a price. And they are striking as deeply as they can into Russia. They're doing so without the benefit of permission from Washington to use American weapons. And I think they will want to show Moscow that just because Washington under a Trump administration might decide to pull the plug, that does not leave Ukraine entirely without options. It does have European weapons. It does have weapons of its own manufacture. And it will remain very much minded to continue the fight.
Sam Green is a professor of Russian politics at King's College London. The United Nations is conducting an investigation into war crimes in Sudan. A panel of experts sent by the UN Security Council arrived in Sudan on Sunday. Another group visited the country this past spring. The current panel is looking into allegations of war crimes committed by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. The RSF has been locked in a civil war with Sudan's National Army for well over a year. This new inquiry is confined to the Sudanese state of Darfur. Cameron Hudson is a former CIA analyst and served as a national security official in several U.S. administrations. He keeps a close eye on Sudan.
They're trying to document with greater clarity on the ground. So much of what has emerged from Darfur over the course of the 18 months of this war has been cell phone coverage. It's been user-generated videos and photos. And so I think for this evidence to be used in an eventual prosecution, for example, at the International Criminal Court, there has to be an established chain of custody of what happened, an established set of facts meeting international standards. And so that's what this fact-finding mission intends to do.
There have been concerns about war crimes, possible war crimes, all across Sudan during the civil war. Why is this investigation limited to Darfur?
Much of the international architecture for responding to the crimes that are being committed all across Sudan are limited right now to the existing mandates and authorities that were established 20 years ago when the genocide in Darfur was unfolding. Old and existing authorities from nearly 20 years ago, and that's the case with sanctions, that's the case with the arms embargo. All of these tools are limited. The UN is only mandated to investigate those crimes being committed in Darfur because of these old mandates that they have.
Right. You mentioned the arms embargo. There are allegations about violations of an arms embargo in Sudan. Who are the suspects in question, and is the panel looking into those violations?
Well, they're looking into the violations to the extent that they are happening in Darfur. I think the problem is that most of the arms that are acquired outside of Darfur and they are brought in. And so, you know, so it's the RSF that is violating the arms embargo when it purchases weapons outside the country or when it's given weapons by the United Arab Emirates in neighboring Chad and brings them in itself. So it's probably the principal violator of those arms embargoes. But for example, the Sudanese army is also purchasing weapons from Russia, from Iran, from Egypt, from Turkey. And to the extent that it uses those weapons inside Darfur, even if it's not using them against Darfuri civilians, if it's using them against the RSF, that's still a violation of the arms embargo.
What kind of evidence have you seen of the RSF violating arms imports?
The RSF could not sustain a war across the entire country for 18 months if it weren't violating this arms embargo every single day. Mm. And so whether it has been the open source intelligence of flights emanating from the United Arab Emirates coming into eastern Chad along the border with Darfur, some as many as four, five, six times a week, large C-130 aircrafts, their satellite imagery of these cargo planes being unloaded in eastern Chad, stockpiling weapons on the tarmac. You know, this is all available through commercial satellite imagery and open source flight radar tracking. So it's not a big secret. What the fact finders have to do, though, is determine and match up a set of serial numbers for where they came from to their use in Darfur. They have to be able to demonstrate through shell casings and other debris left behind that these weapons are, in fact, not just crossing the border, but they are being used to harm civilians in Darfur.
Cameron, as you know, I mean, the reports from Darfur suggest such a level of violence and chaos there with refugees trying to move to Chad. Realistically, what can this panel learn on the ground?
Well, they can learn quite a lot. They can, again, learn how certain weapons have been used. They can document the use of those weapons. They can obviously tell the story, taking eyewitness accounts. So they can really establish a pattern of violence that will ultimately, I think, lead to command authority.
So when you say command authority, you're referring to the RSF's commander, Hemeti.
One of the excuses that the Rapid Support Forces leadership uses oftentimes is to say, well, we've lost control of these troops. And I think what this investigation can do is they will be able to establish, in fact, that these were not just one-off abuses, that there was a clear chain of command that was being implemented here when these crimes were committed.
Cameron Hudson is a former CIA analyst and national security official who follows events in Sudan closely. The euphoria experienced in Germany 35 years ago when the Berlin Wall came down has been replaced with something decidedly less euphoric. Many people in the former East Germany express a sense of weariness or even outright anger about the direction their country is taking today. The concern, for example, over recent local elections where the far-right AfD party saw big gains. Alongside these elections for adult voters, Germany also holds mock elections for kids who are not old enough to vote. The AfD cleaned up in those elections as well, especially in the German states of Thuringia and Saxony. Suggesting support for the far right is also a trend among teenagers there. Schools and mainstream politicians have been caught off guard. Reporter Valerie Hamilton has more from Thuringia.
11th grader Maya Zalbitzer has served on student council longer than many politicians ever stay in office. She was president of her first grade class. And now 10 years later, she represents her home state of Thuringen at Germany's National Student Council Association. She says in that time, school life here has changed a lot. Swastikas on the walls and desks, verbal and even physical attacks on immigrants, extremist slogans in the schoolyard. It's all increased recently, she says. Just a few years ago, far-right stuff like this, especially Nazi symbols, would have been taboo in German schools, where part of the mandate is to teach kids about the Nazi past so it never happens again. But Zalbitzer says as the AfD and its extremist politics have gained popularity, extremist behavior in school has too. That's because, she says, the AfD is really good at winning over young people. AfD has more than twice the reach on TikTok, for first-time voters at least, than the other major German parties combined. Some of that content is punchy messaging from candidates or organizers. Some of it is not. Like this video game, released by AfD's National Youth Wing. It looks like Candy Crush, but instead of stacking candies, players deport immigrants and turn pride flags into German flags. If it sounds made for young people, it is. At a mall food court in the city of Weimar, I asked Raman, a 10th grader from Saxony, about AfD's appeal. In Germany, media don't use kids' last names, so we're respecting that custom.
They make good videos, and yeah, I think young people like that.
Raman voted for AfD in the kids' election. He sees AfD as conservative, not extremist, and reasonable, considering some of the things he hears.
Lots of immigrants come here, also illegal, and you hear in the newspaper and in social media and stuff about crimes and murders and rapes.
At a nearby table, I met another group of high schoolers, all from immigrant backgrounds. I spoke with Mohammed and Bayar. They say AfD is all over their social media feeds.
We are not for AfD.
Other political parties don't use social media, so they don't get to connect with the young people. They know their ways, they know how to get to them and how to present the message.
The boys wish their schools would talk more about politics and tamp down the hate.
For me, it's the problem that the teachers don't tell all the information about the parties.
The problem is that the teacher doesn't have the freedom of speech because he can't say, oh, don't choose the AfD.
What teachers can and can't say is a hot topic for the AfD. AfD's leader in Thuringen is a former high school history teacher who campaigned in part on ending mandatory education about the Nazi era. In some German states, AfD has web hotlines to report teachers who criticize the far right, something the National Teachers Union calls intimidation. Educators I spoke with say many teachers don't know what to do. In a survey by the Thuringen Teachers Union earlier this year, 92% said their training did not prepare them for extremism in the classroom. So it's students who are stepping up. The state student councils from Thuringen, Saxony, and other eastern states put out a public plea for schools to fight extremism with more education in democracy, political judgment, and skills to suss out disinformation. They made national headlines and got invited to Berlin for talks with the government. So far, says Maya Zalbitzer, nothing has changed in Thuringen schools.
In der Schule selbst haben wir da auch keine Resonanz gespürt.
But she thinks at least their message is getting through.
Durchaus, dass es angekommen ist, auf jeden Fall.
One message has, for sure.
Herzlich willkommen zu unserer Sendung, in der wir gleich
Sabitzer went on a national TV talk show to talk politics with members of the Green and Christian Democratic parties, which both lost support from young voters in the recent elections.
Fragen an Maya Zaubitzer. Herzlich willkommen. Freue mich sehr.
Guten Abend.
The politician's burning question, how to get more views on TikTok. For The World, Valerie Hamilton, Weimar, Germany.
Tomorrow, some East Germans are not only unhappy about the way things are going now, they're yearning for life under communism.
They are creating an image of the good old past, which never existed. But most of these people, deep inside, know that this is not correct.
In part two of our series, we'll take a look at what's being called Ostalgie, nostalgia for the ease of life in the former East Germany. That's coming up on the show tomorrow. Emperor penguins. They are very social animals. They normally live together in giant colonies in Antarctica. So it's a little unusual for a couple of reasons that a single emperor penguin showed up on the shoreline of Australia. It's an adult male just over 3 feet tall, and he was malnourished when found on a tourist beach some 2,200 miles from home. His body weighed about half the average of an adult emperor penguin. He's now being cared for by a government wildlife expert in Western Australia. The penguin's being sprayed with chilled water mist, trying to make his surroundings a little less alien. The Department of Biodiversity Conservation and Attraction says it's focused on rehabilitating the penguin, but isn't sure yet if the bird can be returned to Antarctica. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Judith Jameson, described as a goddess of dance, died over the weekend. She was 81. Jameson is best known for performing with the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, which she joined in 1965. But she's also remembered by audiences around the globe as one of the most recognized black female dancers in history, including international tours across Africa and dancing with famed Soviet defector Mikhail Baryshnikov. Sylvia Waters was with the Alvin Ailey Dance American Dance Theater for many years. I asked Waters what she remembers about the first time she met Judith Jameson.
Well, she was on tour in Paris with the company. They were about to perform at the Marais Festival, the Festival du Marais. And I was living in Paris at the time. And I knew all of the company members in Alvin. And I went over to the rehearsal to say hello and, you know, get together. And that's where I met Judith, as she told me her name was at the time. I said, oh, okay, Judith. And we re-met in 1968 when I joined the company. And she was very warm, very welcoming. And she was Judy by that time. And we were best friends ever since.
What can you tell us about the tour Judith Jameson was part of to African countries in 1967? It was under the banner of the U.S. State Department, right?
Yes. They went to several places. I remember they talked about Kenya a lot and Mombasa Beach. They always talked about that. She and Dudley Williams, a fellow dancer. And she loved Africa. And many times, the people there in the various countries and communities embraced her as one of their own. You know, one chief wanted to keep her in Kenya. He thought she was a family member.
I mean, how did she see the tour? I mean, was it just about taking modern dance to Africa? Because this is 1967, the post-colonial era in so many African countries. They're shedding their European colonizers and establishing independence.
Well, I think she saw herself as part, really, of a world community. There she, I think, felt her roots. And when she set foot on an African country, she felt very, very much a part of that, innately somehow. And she returned to Africa several times with the company. And also on separate projects that she did. She worked with the Moudra Company in Senegal with Maurice Béjart at one point. And she went another time to produce other choreographic projects with people in Senegal. So she was very fond of Africa, and Africa was very fond of her. I think in Ghana, I don't know what the particular title was they gave her, but it was a very, very important title in Accra, Ghana. It's like coming home, she said. It's like coming home. You really somehow felt at home, if you know what I mean.
It's notable that the State Department tours of American artists out in the world. I'm just wondering how Judith Jameson felt she was received by an international audience representing kind of a black woman from America.
I think she really embraced it. She was very aware of her connection to European audiences. You know, the audience did not spare anything in responding to her and the company. So she was very aware of that. She felt very at home there with audiences as well as at home.
Was she influenced at all by African dance once she was touring the continent?
Absolutely. She loved drum. I mean, drum was the heartbeat. And she used very often in the choreography, she used a lot of drumming percussion. She loved rhythmic music, very much so. And she was extraordinarily musical herself, yes.
And in the heart of ballet, the ballet world, there's Mikhail Baryshnikov. I've seen photographs of them dancing together. What relationship did they have?
A very amicable one as artists, you know. There were no boundaries. There were no language barrier there. They knew the language of dance as artists. That was their language, movement.
Yeah, well, Mikhail Baryshnikov is quoted as saying, needless to say, I was stunned by how deftly she combined emotional eloquence with restraint. So that's the language of dance, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Sylvia, as you describe this kind of global community around Judith Jameson's approach to dance, I'm just wondering, in the decades to come, what do you think her legacy will be in the world of dance?
The epitome of excellence. Excellence was her, you know, her motto, really. And she influenced so many people. She inspired so many people. And she gave to so many people. And she's a legend. She's a legend. That's not going away.
Sylvia Waters is the Artistic Director Emerita at ALEE 2. She joined us from New York to remember dancer Judith Jameson, who has died at age 81. One more item before we let you go this Monday. Over the weekend in Mexico City, more than 1,000 musicians gathered at the city's main plaza to play mariachi music. The idea was to set a new world record for the most people playing mariachi in unison and singing harmony. The previous record of 700 is set in 2013 in Guadalajara, which is considered the birthplace of mariachi. Now 700 people playing trumpets, violins, the vihuela, and bass guitars while belting out lyrics, as you'd expect. That's already really loud. But records are made to be broken, and it just feels good to get a lot of people together in one place making music. Diana Rocia Campos was there. She told the Associated Press that mariachi has a special effect on people. It doesn't matter where people come from, she says. They get excited when they hear mariachi. Not just people from Mexico, people from other countries too. In Mexico, mariachi tradition is passed down through families. Kids start learning at a young age. Jesus Morales told the AP that he started learning violin when he was 8, and he joined a band with his uncles in Hidalgo at the age of 13.
Esa herencia que nos...
He says it was mainly my dad who instilled in us this heritage of having respect for music and respect for our roots. No word yet from the folks over at Guinness about whether the previous world record has now been officially broken, but the utter joy of 1,000 people playing mariachi in Mexico City speaks for itself. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Check out the full spread of our reporting from around the globe at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.